You're listening to ESL Podcast English Cafe, number 576. This is English as a Second Language Podcast, English Cafe, episode 576. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff McQuillan, coming to you from the Center for Educational Development in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Go to ESLPOD.com. Why? Because you can take a look at our ESL podcast store if you do. In it, you'll find all sorts of interesting English courses to help you improve your fluency even faster. On this cafe, we're going to talk about the American writer James Baldwin. We're also going to talk about a popular song from the 20th century, High Hopes. And as always, we'll answer a few of your questions. Let's get started. James Arthur Baldwin was born in August of 1924 in New York City. He was the oldest of nine children and grew up in the neighborhood of New York City, which is still to this day associated with the African American community, Harlem. At the time, Harlem was an area that was almost exclusively or solely lived in by blacks or African Americans. Baldwin did not grow up with his biological father. In fact, his mother never told him the name of his father. Instead, he was raised by the man his mother married after he was born, a man who was a preacher by the name of David Baldwin. A preacher, P-R-E-A-C-H-E-R, is a person who gives religious talks. We might call them religious speeches or homilies in a public place, often in a church, but not always. The Baldwin family was very poor, and David Baldwin was very strict with his children. To be strict, S-T-R-I-C-T, means often to have a lot of rules and to require people to follow those rules exactly. If we describe a parent as being strict with his or her children, we mean the parent usually requires the child to follow the rules perfectly or nearly so. When Baldwin was growing up, during the 1920s and 30s, African Americans, as you know, were certainly not treated the same as whites, or perhaps we could say even worse than today. Baldwin had many negative experiences, especially with police officers, that made him an angry young man. He joined a church, however, when he was 14 and decided to become, very briefly, a preacher himself. He was very good at giving these sermons, these religious talks, and became very popular even though he was only a teenager. He did this for about 2 years and then decided that he didn't want to be a religious person anymore. In fact, he stopped believing in God completely. He left the church and preaching and decided to focus instead on writing. When he was 15 years old, he finished high school early and moved to an area in New York City, south of Harlem, considerably south on the island of Manhattan, called Greenwich Village. Now, Greenwich Village, you may know, is a neighborhood in New York City that is known for its artists. Even to this day, it has that association, but especially during the early and mid-20th century. Baldwin got interested in writing. He worked in a lot of different places, enough to make money so that he could continue writing. In 1948, not unlike other African-American artists during the mid-20th century, Baldwin moved to France, in particular to Paris, France. He said he was tired of being treated as a person unequal to whites in his own country. He was tired of the discrimination against African Americans during this period. He lived in France until 1956, and during that time, he became friends with both American and French artists, writers, painters, and so forth. He also wrote his most famous novel, some would say it's his best novel, called Go Tell It on the Mountain. That expression, Go Tell It on the Mountain, is actually from an old religious hymn or religious song. The idea is that you would go up on top of a mountain or a high place and announce this wonderful news. The wonderful news is that Jesus Christ is born. Go tell it on a mountain that Jesus Christ is born. It's a famous, what we would call, spiritual or traditional African-American religious song that Baldwin surely learned as a child and was known to most people and is still known today and sung in churches. The book is basically an autobiography or based on the life of Baldwin himself, growing up in Harlem, growing up poor with a strict father, and preaching in church. I say he grew up with a strict father, but it wasn't his biological father. It was what we would call his step, STEP father. Your stepfather is the man who is legally your father, but wasn't actually there, well, 9 months before you were born. In any case, Go Tell It on the Mountain was based on Baldwin's life. That is, it was taken from the real events of his own life. This is not unusual for a first-time novelist to use his own experiences. F. Scott Fitzgerald's first novel is partially autobiographical, that is, it's partly based on his own experiences growing up in my hometown of St. Paul, Minnesota. That novel was This Side of Paradise, by the way. Baldwin's novel is still read in American schools and is considered by some to be a classic, one of the better novels written in the 20th century. In 1956, Baldwin published another book that was much more controversial, that is, that people thought perhaps was a little too extreme or perhaps talked about things that many people would disagree with. The book told the story of a young gay man, a man who preferred or was romantically attracted to other men. This book, called Giovanni's Room, talked about something that was not commonly talked about in American novels during this time, what we would nowadays call sexual orientation, O-R-I-E-N-T-A-T-I-O-N. Sexual orientation refers to one's preferences, sexually in terms of men and women. Baldwin said that he himself was attracted to other men, and to talk about this in a novel was certainly controversial at the time. Baldwin returned to the United States from France in 1957 and became active in the civil rights movement of that period. The civil rights movement was about getting African Americans equality before the law, ending laws that discriminated against African Americans. Baldwin himself was not in favor of using violence in order to get the civil rights that he believed African Americans deserved, although he was not exactly on the same page, we might say, that is, not completely in agreement with Martin Luther King and his nonviolent approach. He was himself a socialist and believed in certain social changes as well as in changes that would affect the status of African Americans before the law. He was then, in addition to being in favor of civil rights, also something of a radical in terms of his other political views. Baldwin wasn't just a novelist, he was also a journalist. He wrote essays, poems, and other writings about what was going on in American society during this period. He continued to publish novels. He published a new novel every year from 1961 to 1963 and a play in 1964. Baldwin was never completely happy with the changes that took place during the 1960s in America, and so he decided in 1970 to return to France, this time living in a small town in the southeastern part of France. And there he remained pretty much for the rest of his life until his death in 1987. Baldwin is remembered now both for his original novel, his first novel, I should say, as well as for some of his essays. His other books, I would say, are less read than Go Tell It on a Mountain, but can still be easily found. We turn now to a famous song from the 20th century, High Hopes. The expression high, H-I-G-H, hopes, H-O-P-E-S, refers to having expectations about something good that will happen in the future. When you feel that something good will happen, you have high hopes. We often use the preposition for, F-O-R. I have high hopes for a certain thing. I have high hopes for the Los Angeles Dodgers to win the World Series of Baseball this year. I have high hopes. I expect it. I am optimistic, we might say, about it. The song High Hopes was written by Jimmy Van Heusen and Sammy Kahn for a movie called A Hole in the Head. The song was sung by Frank Sinatra. Sinatra in the movie plays a father, and he sings the song to his son in the movie, who is played by the young actor Eddie Hodges. The song is meant to tell the son to keep trying even when things are hard, even when things are difficult. The song begins, "Next time you're found with your chin on the ground, there's a lot to be learned, so look around." The expression to have your chin, C-H-I-N, on the ground means to be very sad or to be what we might describe as discouraged, D-I-S-C-O-U-R-A-G-E-D. To be discouraged means you don't have hope. You don't think good things will happen in the future. By the way, the word chin describes that part of your face that is the lower part of your mouth. We sometimes talk about people having a long face. To have a long face means to be sad. So if you had a really long face, I guess your chin would be on the ground, and that perhaps is where the expression comes from. We can now understand then the first verse or part of the song. Next time you're found with your chin on the ground, there's a lot to be learned. So look around, look about you, and see that you shouldn't be sad. What should you look for? Well, the song tells us. It says, just what makes that little old ant think he'll move that rubber tree plant? Anyone knows that ant can't move a rubber tree plant. Well, what's all that about? An ant, A-N-T, is a very small little insect that lives on the ground, and usually with lots of other little ants. Now, sometimes a whole group of ants is able to move a large amount of, say, dirt by working together. A rubber tree plant is a plant that grows a kind of flexible, strong material called rubber. You'll find rubber tree plants or trees in South America, for example. Now, we wouldn't expect a little ant to be able to move a whole tree, and of course, one small ant cannot. The idea of the song is that little ants, even though they are small, are able to move a lot of things, do much more than it looks like they can do, because they are able to work together. So even though it seems as though the little ant cannot move anything as large as a rubber tree plant, you can have high hopes that the ant will be able to do it. And that's the next most famous part of the song. But he's got high hopes. He's got high hopes. He goes high apple pie in the sky hopes. So the little ant has high hopes. How high? He goes high apple pie in the sky hopes. Well, that's another weird expression. The expression pie, P-I-E, in the sky, S-K-Y, means unrealistic. Someone who has pie in the sky ideas is someone who is dreaming about things that could never happen or things that are impossible. Well, the little ant, according to the song, has pie in the sky hopes. The song actually says he's got high apple pie in the sky hopes. The original expression doesn't have apple in it, but it kind of makes it funny. The little ant has high apple pie in the sky hopes. The rest of the song is, so anytime you're getting low, that is, anytime you feel sad, instead of letting go, instead of giving up, just remember that ant. Think about the little ant and how much it is able to do, even though it is small. Then the song ends with a line that is also famous. Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant. Oops, O-O-P-S, is an expression, we would call it an interjection, when you are surprised about something or when you make a mistake. In this case, it indicates surprise. Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant refers to the idea that the little ants are moving this rubber tree plant and you are watching it go by, even though it seems impossible that an ant can move a rubber tree plant. Oops, there goes another rubber tree. Oops, there goes another rubber tree. Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant. Although most Americans just know that first part of the song, the original song, sung by Frank Sinatra, continues on giving another example of another animal, a ram, R-A-M, which is able to do things you would not expect it to be able to do. The song was so popular that in 1960, it won an Oscar, an Academy Award, for the best song in a movie for that year. It also became one of Frank Sinatra's most famous songs. In fact, it was so famous that one of the men who was running for president that year in 1960, John F. Kennedy, asked Sinatra to create a version of the song that could be used for his campaign, as his campaign song. A campaign, C-A-M-P-A-I-G-N, is the process of trying to get elected to public office. It's that period of time and the activities involved in a person trying to win an election, to get the most votes, in this case, to become president. Frank Sinatra did, in fact, write a version of the song for Kennedy. The Kennedy version, of course, went a little differently. The Kennedy song said, "Everyone is voting for Jack." Jack was the nickname for John Kennedy, because he's got what all the rest, all the other people, lack. L-A-C-K. To lack means you don't have something. You're missing something. Everyone wants to back Jack. To back, B-A-C-K, someone, means to support someone. So everyone is supporting Jack. Jack, the song continues, is on the right track, T-R-A-C-K. The expression to be on the right track means that you are doing the right things or moving in the right direction in order to achieve some objective or reach some goal. So everyone is voting for Jack because he's got what all the rest lack. Everyone wants to back Jack. Jack is on the right track. The song then continues, because he's got high hopes, meaning John Kennedy has high hopes. He's got high hopes. 1960's the year for his high hopes. Come on and vote for Kennedy. Vote for Kennedy. We'll come out on top. To come out on top means to win, to be victorious, to beat everyone else. Of course, the Kennedy campaign wants to elect Jack Kennedy, and so they want to win the election. They want to come out on top. Then the song ends with, "Oops, there goes the opposition, kerplop." The opposition refers to the people you are trying to beat, or in this case, Richard Nixon, who was the Republican candidate, whom, in fact, Jack Kennedy did beat in the 1960 election. Kerplop, K-E-R-P-L-O-P, is an unusual word. You don't hear it very often anymore. It's basically the sound that is made when something falls or drops. I don't know what we would say instead nowadays, probably not kerplop, but that word was more common in the middle of the 20th century, and it was also part of the original song in a different verse we didn't talk about. So Kennedy won the election, probably not because of that song. In fact, he barely won the election. It was a very close election, but he did defeat Richard Nixon and win the 1960 election. Now let's answer some of the questions you have sent to us. Our first question comes from Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N, in Argentina. Martin wants to know the difference between homeless, H-O-M-E-L-E-S-S, and destitute, D-E-S-T-I-T-U-T-E. To be homeless means to be without a place to live. The suffix less, L-E-S-S, usually means without. So if you are, for example, penniless, you don't even have a penny. You don't have any money. If you are homeless, you don't have a home, a place to live. Destitute means that you are very poor, so poor that you don't have enough money for your basic needs. Perhaps you don't have enough money to eat, or you don't have enough money to buy clothing. Destitute isn't necessarily the same as homeless, although people who are destitute are also often homeless. The word homeless is often used as a noun to describe people who do not have a place to live, a permanent place to live. Destitute is a little less common of a word, of an adjective. You don't hear that as much, at least in common conversation. We talk about people who are very poor or living in poverty. But destitute is a word you are more likely to see in a novel or in a book. Our next question comes from Thais, T-A-I-S, in Brazil. The question has to do with the word odd, O-D-D, versus odds, O-D-D-S. The word odd has a couple of different meanings. Normally, it's an adjective used to describe something or someone who is strange or unusual, different from what you would expect, usually in a bad way. If you say to someone, "You look odd," you're saying there is something unusual about the person, but also something wrong with the person. There's something that doesn't look right, that looks strange. Odd can also be used to describe different kinds of things that are not all part of the same class or category. If, for example, you have two different socks, but they are different colors, you would say, "I have an odd pair of socks. They don't match. They don't go together." Odd can also be used in math to be the opposite of even. An odd number is 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, and so forth. An even number can be divided by 2, so 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 are even numbers. Those that are not even are odd numbers. You'll sometimes hear people say, "I have an odd number of chairs." That means I have 5 chairs instead of 4 chairs, or 7 chairs instead of 6 chairs. The word odds, with an S at the end, refers to probability and statistics. Odds is normally used to describe the possibility that something will happen. We talk about having good odds and bad odds. Good odds means that it is likely that you will win, or that you will be successful, or that something will happen in the future. We may say, "The odds are that he will win." That means it is likely, or it is probable, that he will win. There's another expression we have, against all odds. To say someone was successful or succeeded against all odds means that he succeeded in very difficult circumstances, in a very difficult situation. No one thought he was going to be successful because it was likely or probable, the odds were, that he would not be successful. But against all odds, he succeeded. That would be another use of that word, odds. You can specify or give the actual mathematical or statistical odds of something happening. You will sometimes hear people say, the odds are 5-1 that this team will win the next game. And in many places, you can actually go and give money to someone, place what we call a bet, B-E-T, that something, someone, some team will win or not win. That ratio of 5-1 is called the odds. There is one other expression with odds, which is at odds. If you are at odds with another person, you disagree with another person. My boss and I are at odds with each other. We don't agree about something. Finally, Behnaz, B-E-H-N-A-Z, in Iran, wants to know the meaning of the expression a has-been. A has, H-A-S, hyphen Ben, B-E-E-N, is a person who was once popular or successful, but is no longer popular or successful. You can think of a famous singer, perhaps, from 20 years ago, who everyone loved and who was very popular. But now, no one listens to his music. He's not popular anymore. He's a has-been. Someone who was once good at something or once popular, but is no longer good at that thing or no longer popular. There isn't a common expression in English for the opposite of that, or for someone who perhaps might be popular in the future. We don't really say he's a will be, although someone might write that as a way of contrasting with the idea of a has-been. But the expression that you will hear most of the time is a has-been to describe a person who is no longer successful or popular. If you have a question or comment, you can email us. Our email address is eslpod@eslpod.com. From Los Angeles, California, I'm Jeff McQuillan. Thanks for listening. Come back and listen to us again. Right here on the English Cafe.
The ESL podcast English Cafe was written and produced by Dr. Jeff McQuillan and Dr. Lucy Say.
This podcast is copyright 2016 by the Center for Educational Development.